One of the other things that I noticed as I was having these kind of fun, wonderful experiences is how adaptable we are as human beings. And you know that intellectually because you know that there are people living in all kinds of different climates. There are people living in the Arctic Circle. There are people living in the tropics. There are people living up high altitudes where there's not as much oxygen. There are people living in the deserts. There are people living everywhere. And so you kind of know that people are adaptable just because you see it around you, even though you might not think of it like that. But it was something I experienced as an astronaut. You know, as a rookie, you're kind of worried about the first time that you go to space because you really don't have time to get sick on a shuttle flight. You get up there. Shuttle missions were so incredibly complex and time-constrained and busy that when you got to orbit, you had to just heads down, execute, do. Your schedule is so busy that like every 15 minutes, you know, they have 15-minute intervals on the schedule. And they just had it that tightly packed. And we were always behind. And we went to bed 2 hours late every shuttle mission I was on. So you didn't really have time to deal with this new environment and get used to it. And so you're always worried about that. How are you going to adapt to zero-G? Are you going to adapt fast? Are you going to adapt slow? Are you going to be a drag on your crew? What they tell you, actually, as rookies, is for the first 24 hours when you get up there, stay in a 1G orientation, you know, because you're used to training in 1G, right? We can't float on Earth, unfortunately. We can talk about that later. So you're used to kind of seeing everything with reference to a top and a down and a sideways. And so on the orbiter, when you get to orbit, if you just kind of stay in that relative orientation, it helps your brain and your body get used to it. Because you have a fluid in your inner ears that... it's part of your neurovestibular system that uses gravity to tell your brain what your attitude is. And so that's going completely bonko when you get to orbit because there's no gravity anymore and it's kind of sending your brain some mixed signals. And so if you stay in a 1G attitude, you're not getting two different kinds of mixed signals from your brain. Although I have to tell you, the temptation when you float for the first time to head straight down, head first through the access hole to the middeck and take a right turn and skim along the ceiling is really overpowering because it's that much fun. But you have to wait 24 hours if you want to make sure you don't let your crew down. But it was really interesting because after that, I really felt like I'd been there forever. The whole idea of floating around and the whole idea of, you know, pushing off and bouncing off the ceiling and bouncing off the wall and hanging off the ceiling, it felt natural to me. I felt like I'd been doing it forever. I adapted like that. And people do. I mean, it happens over and over again. When you get up there, you just start adapting. Interestingly enough, every time I came home and went back, I adapted faster. Like my body remembered, oh yeah, I know this environment, no problem. Oh yeah, I know this environment, no problem. So that was really an interesting experience. And then when I lived on station for 4.5 months, it was a whole nother level of adapting to space. It became my routine. You know, you have a routine, right? You get up and you take a shower and you eat breakfast and you go to work. Or you might do something with the kids if you have kids. You go to work, you come home, you know, that whole routine. It's you don't even think about it, right? It's a routine you do every day. And that I got to the point where I was so normalized to space, I had this routine I would do every day. To the point that it became totally normal for me to see the Earth out my window, coming and going. Because it only takes us 90 minutes to go around the Earth, so every 45 minutes you have a sunset or a sunrise. And please come in. There's some chairs right over here if you'd like to sit down. And there's some in the back too, but there's a couple over there. Anyway, so you get used to this light dark, looking out the window to the point where after a while I realized I had stopped looking out the window at the Earth, which is a really special thing I'll talk about in the next slide. And I was like, wow, I've totally adapted to this. This is like normal for me. And I stopped one day and was like, no, this is not normal. You're living in a tin can full of air, 300 to 400 kilometers above the Earth. This is not normal. You need to stop and smell the roses and look out the window. So I got back into the habit of looking out the window. But I had adapted so much to that routine because I lived in space. It was just like you moved to Australia for 4.5 months. I moved to space for 4.5 months and created a whole routine. And that was really interesting. Then I started thinking about it later. And I thought, wow, this is a really powerful tool that we have as humans to adapt. It means no matter what situation you run into, you're going to adapt to it and you'll be fine. But then I started thinking, wow, this really explains how some people get into very bad situations and they get stuck there, because you can adapt just as easily to a bad situation as you can to a good situation. And you can get into a situation where that is your norm and you don't even think about it anymore. So just be aware of that. That human adaptability is a really, it's a strength, but it's a tool that can be used against you as well. And that was sort of a perception shift I had on human adaptability. But it's a really powerful tool. So one of the questions I get, especially from young students when I talk to them, is, did you miss TV while you were in space? No, really, I do get this question. So first of all, they can ship us up TV shows for those who are wondering. But I said no, because actually I have a really great view out the window when I remember to look at it. I've got this really great view out the window, and it's just fascinating. You can't help but take lots of pictures and look at it and try and figure out ways to describe it to people. And I took about 18,000 photos when I lived on Space Station, which is nowhere near a record. Some of the crews are taking 50 or 60,000 photos now because they can do time-lapse photography, which I'll show you in a minute. But it's just fascinating. And my first mission, I was in charge of opening the Pala Bay doors. And when we get to orbit, the orbiter kind of goes upside down, if you will, so the Pala Bay doors face the Earth, because the inside of the Pala Bay doors is our cooling system, and so we have to open the Pala Bay doors to expose the radiators, and then they're facing away from the sun, so they work well. And so as soon as I opened the Pala Bay doors, I had my first view of the Earth. And it was just incredible. But what was really interesting was, you know, the first words out of my mouth, from it was really brain to mouth, was, oh my gosh, our atmosphere is so thin. Because it was so shocking to look out the window that first time and see the planet and see this, no kidding, I mean, thin eggshell of air that is surrounding our planet. I was like, oh my gosh. Back to the water fountains. Oh my gosh, we so can't take that for granted. I mean, it was incredibly shocking. And you guys all know this intellectually because you can do the math, right? The people in the Himalayas, you know, they climb Mount Everest, and I'm going to use imperial units, I apologize, I'm American, 29,000 feet and some change to get up there, and you have to have supplemental oxygen because the atmosphere is so thin already, and the circumference of the Earth is about 25,000 miles and some change, so you can do the math and go, yeah, that's a really thin layer of air. But there's a big difference, and I think many of you know this, between knowledge that's intellectual and knowledge that's experiential. And so you know intellectually the atmosphere is really thin. I know by experience the atmosphere is really thin, and it's scary to see such a thin eggshell of air that basically is our spaceship. You know, the planet looks like a spaceship with this thin layer of air that's circling it, that keeps us all alive. It's very fragile, and it's very beautiful. And it's definitely a water planet, because most of the time when you're flying over, you're over water. So you see blue and you see white, because there are clouds everywhere, weather patterns everywhere. So it's very much alive. And it's just awe-inspiring. And there are certain things you start to notice as you fly around the planet. You know, flew over the outback here in Australia, and as you fly over in the daylight, there's a lot of red light reflected up from the outback. Whereas over the Sahara, which is the picture up there behind me that I'll talk about in a minute, you get orange light. So I got to the point where I could tell if there was red light coming through the window. It's like, oh, we're over Australia. Orange light, oh, we're over the Mideast. So you get to know the planet really well. Cities look like smudges. We tend to build things very geometric, we human beings. So you can kind of tell what a city is, just because it's, first of all, it's a smudge, it's not really that attractive, and second of all, it's very geometric. Across South Africa, there are just straight lines of roads, just very geometric, they don't waver. Mother Nature tends to be a little bit more curvy and spontaneous. If you look at the rivers in South America from on orbit, by the way, I never knew there were so many rivers in South America. It's so startling from orbit to see how they all intertwine and how much water really is down there. But it's very curvy. That picture up in your left corner, that's from the South Pacific. It's a little reflective of what happens when you get around atolls and islands and reefs and things like that. I tried for a month to take a good picture of the Great Barrier Reef, but it was your summertime while I was on orbit, and there seemed to be always clouds there. One of the other areas that I really enjoyed was the Caribbean. The Caribbean is absolutely beautiful because it's a whole bunch of barrier reefs, or reefs and islands, and you can everything from the midnight dark blue of deep ocean to some of these aquamarines and things were there, and it looks like a piece of modern art as you see all these colors of blue just unfurling below you in the Caribbean. That was just a great place. In the Sahara, they have some interesting structures. I never really thought of deserts much. I mean, it's a pile of sand, right? How interesting can it be? But you go over something like the Sahara, and you've got these lines of sand dunes that look like waves on a beach. And I took a bunch of pictures of them because I was so fascinated, and I added that to my bucket list. I have to go stand next to one of these sand dunes and see just how big they are. And interestingly enough, across in the Arabian Peninsula, instead of lines and waves of sand dunes, they have little comma-shaped sand dunes over there. So the weather patterns, for some reason, I still don't know why, the weather patterns were completely different and carving the earth and the sand in a completely different way. Now, at nighttime, it was a little bit different story. At nighttime, the cities actually lit up and were quite beautiful. And you can tell at a glance where the people lived around the world. And it's coastlines. We love our coastlines, except for Europe, which is uniformly pretty crowded. So if you want open space, don't go to Europe. But the middle of the continents, a lot of them were much, much darker and less illuminated because people just don't live there. Thunderstorms, the picture at the bottom on this side, that's a picture of some lightning I managed to capture. There's better video out there now from crews who've got better cameras than I had, but lightning storms were absolutely spectacular, because you get hundreds of miles of this cloud-to-cloud lightning just flickering, flickering, flickering. And it was just fascinating to watch. And then the other thing I'll show you is, you know, the time-lapse videos that crews are doing now, because we have such great cameras, you have things like this. These are the Southern Lights. And what they did was they took exposures like every 30 seconds, every 15 seconds, and put it together in a movie. That goes through a night pass, and you know, with things like that, you don't need TV, right? They'll usually show that to kids. By the way, you can see these kinds of videos now on YouTube, because a lot of the videos the crews are putting out there and the different space agencies are releasing to YouTube. So if you go to YouTube and type, you know, astronaut videos from space or ISS videos or something like that, you should be able to find them. There's a couple of really great night passes out there. But again, what was really obvious looking at the Earth was it was our spaceship, and it's funny, you know, you go off the planet and you see it differently, right? I saw it as a spaceship with a thin layer of air, but I also looked at it in the context of it being a spaceship. It's a closed system, just like space station is a closed system. And it's hard for you to imagine that or visualize that because you've never left the planet. And it's hard for you to think, you know, in a closed system, everything affects each other, right? Because it's a closed, and so the interactions and everything's kind of connected. But, you know, you walk outside and you stand on the street here in Melbourne, and it's really hard to imagine that something that's going on here could have an impact, say, in Texas or in Dubai or at the South Pole. But I'm telling you it does, because I've seen it as a closed system where it's obvious that everything that we do interacts together. Just like on station, you know, one of the most challenging things that we have to manage in that closed system of the space station is trash. It's something you don't think about here. What do you do with your trash? You put it in a bag and you put it on the street and it magically disappears and it goes away, right? You never think about it ever again. On station, we don't have the luxury of doing that. We have to deal with the trash. And for some reason, people constantly are worrying about launch loads of equipment, and which means they wrap it up very well. So there's bubble wrap, and there's foam, and there's packing material, and all this stuff gets to orbit, and we have to do something with it. We can't just put it in a bag and put it at the curb and let it go magically disappear. We have to manage it, and we have to manage it at a really, really incredibly detailed level. Some of the foam actually has a serial number on it. And we have to track it by serial number. We've got to find a place to put it so that 4 months later when the cargo vehicles come up and we unload the cargo vehicle and we put our trash in it, we've got to find, you know, serial number one piece of foam and put it exactly this place in the cargo vehicle. Because you've got to have a really good understanding of the center of mass of your vehicle when you're deorbiting to make sure it stays under control. So the overhead of dealing with trash is absolutely amazing. And it's all accounted for because it's a closed system. We have to understand where it's coming from. We have to understand where we're temporarily putting it. We have to understand if we can reuse it or not. We have to understand how it's going to go away. So trash on Earth, we don't think about it. It just goes to the curb and it magically disappears. Well, I would argue we are in a closed system, so we should be worrying about stuff like that. You know, it's a big closed system, right? So there's a lot more capacity. I mean, if I was on station and I had a whole other module just to put trash into. It would be a lot easier to manage, but eventually that would get filled up and I'd have to deal with it. So on Earth, we have a bigger closed system, but eventually we're going to fill up the capacity, and we need to think about how we're looking at our planet. And that was a real revelation to me, to be able to draw those parallels between our closed system on station and then looking down at the Earth and seeing that same kind of a system there, but just on a grander scale. So it changed my perception a little bit about the Earth.